Going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight Segment. I'm Harold Fisher. He's an Ivy Leaguer, and he headed the U.S. Department of Education during the Obama administration. Now, Democrat John King is taking a run at the governor's office in Maryland. He joins us today for our Candidates Corner series. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810, and you can tweet me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. And of course, don't forget, you can hear all of our interviews with the candidates via podcast on our website, WHUR.com. Mr. King, thank you so much for joining the conversation.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Absolutely. So let's get right into it as we ask all of our interview subjects. Tell me about yourself. Certainly, you know, as a news person, I'm familiar with your background, but some voters may not be. So give it a run. What do you want people to know about you?
Sure. Well, you know, I decided to run for governor really for the same reasons I got into public service in the first place. A really deep belief in the role that public institutions can play in people's lives. And I know that because of the role public school played in my life when I was a kid. Growing up, both my parents were educators. My mom was a teacher and school counselor. My dad was a teacher and administrator. But they both passed away when I was little. My mom when I was 8 and my dad when I was 12. And in the period when it was just my dad and me, my dad was struggling with Alzheimer's. And so home was scary and unstable. And the thing that saved me was school. It was the one place in my life that was safe and consistent and supportive. And then as a teenager, after my dad passed when I was 12, I moved around different family members, different schools, and I struggled a lot the way a lot of young people do who've experienced trauma. Got in a lot of trouble, actually got kicked out of high school. And I was very lucky that rather than look at me as a Black Puerto Rican kid, family in crisis, no respect for authority, and just writing me off, folks saw promise in me that I didn't even see in myself, gave me a second chance, and because of teachers and a school counselor intervened in my life, I was able to become an educator. I was a high school teacher, a middle school principal, led schools at the local level and state level before coming to work for President Obama. And since the end of the administration, I've been running an education civil rights organization called the Education Trust. And, you know, as an educator, you see how all the other systems impact kids and families, from housing to criminal justice to health care to food insecurity. And governors are uniquely positioned to work across all those different policy areas to help make people's lives better. And so that's why I'm running.
You're not a Marylander. You're a New Yorker. You've not been in this part of the world very long compared to the lion's share of some of the other candidates. Are you concerned that that may give some Maryland voters pause? Why should they vote for someone who's from New York as opposed to spending more time in Maryland?
You know, I was born in New York, and then after my parents passed away, I moved around all over, really, the country, and decided to settle in Maryland really because of my wife. My wife grew up in D.C. Her parents lived in Bethesda, Maryland. We wanted schools that were public schools, that were racially diverse and socioeconomically diverse, so we chose to raise our girls in Montgomery County, who live in Silver Spring. And I'm actually the only candidate across all of the Democrats and Republicans who has a kid right now in public school in Maryland. And of course, my family has very, very deep roots in Maryland. I live about 25 miles from where my great-grandfather was enslaved in Gaithersburg, Maryland. and actually the property is still owned by the family that are direct line descendants of the family that enslaved my family, and the cabin that my great-grandfather and his family lived in as enslaved people still standing on the property. So I feel a tremendous sense of connection through my wife and through my ancestors to Maryland. Of course, my grandmother actually graduated from University of Maryland Eastern Shore in 1894, amongst the earliest graduates of UMES. So I also feel a deep connection to UMES and the Eastern Shore as well.
Known as Maryland State College back then, as a matter of fact. Let's talk a little bit about what has happened over the past 24 hours. As you know, the region, and more specifically Maryland, has been hit by a really rough storm. You know, if you were governor today, what would be your posture in providing relief, if any at all, for those who have been hit by the storm? And do you believe that the kind of difficult weather that we've been seeing in this region is indeed a result of climate change?
You know, when I was leading at the state level and at the federal level, I often had to work with schools and communities when there were natural disasters. I think government plays a critical role in providing immediate support and safety for folks, but then also helping people recover, whether it's their homes or businesses or schools. That's a vital role. Unfortunately, we are, I think, going to see more terrible consequences from natural disasters around the country because of climate change. We already see much more significant flooding than we have in the past in many parts of the state. So stormwater management, smart strategies to make communities more resilient, like developing green space near waterfront so that there's a way for the water to overflow and be absorbed, cover crops in more rural areas. You know, we have to take seriously that climate change is going to disrupt our day-to-day life, and we've got to be prepared to make our communities resilient. And look, I've been the candidate who's been most ambitious in articulating the things we need to do to combat climate change. You know, we really have to take on our reliance on fossil fuels and move to renewable energy if we want to prevent even more horrific consequences from climate change down the road.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. This is the Candidates Corner. We're talking to Democrat John King as he throws his hat in the ring for governor of Maryland. If you have a comment, if you have a question for Mr. King, give us a call. Lines, of course, are open until about 8 o'clock at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that are on your agenda for the state of Maryland, your platform, as it were. Last night, we spoke to Comptroller Peter Franchot, and he spoke about a black and brown agenda for the state. Your thoughts about the situation with people of color in the state, economically, socially, and the like, and what would you do about it if you were elected?
Yeah, look, we have tremendous disparities in opportunity, in wealth, in health, in education, based on race in the state. If we're honest about it, that has deep ties to our history, from slavery to segregation to redlining. And so, you know, I have been very clear in putting forward a black agenda to say we've got to tackle those inequities holistically across policy areas. So it means we've got to close educational opportunity gaps. We know the state is historically underinvested in schools serving students of color, particularly in Baltimore and Prince George's County. The General Assembly passed a bill not long ago called the Blueprint for Maryland's Future to try to close that gap. Comptroller Francher actually opposed that bill at the time. That was unfortunate because that's going to get more resources to our highest need schools. We have big gaps in transportation. One of the worst things that Governor Hogan did in his time in office, as you know, was canceling the Red Line project, which was a rail project in Baltimore that would have connected neighborhoods that are struggling economically with where the jobs are. And Governor Hogan also failed to invest in public transportation more broadly, bus service, building the Southern Maryland Light Rail project, actually finishing the Purple Line, expanding the MARC West, increasing the frequency of MARC trains. All of those public transportation issues are racial equity issues because that's how folks can access jobs and health care. We have big health disparities in the state, particularly maternal health disparities for African American women. The state needs to be very aggressive in making sure that we have enough health providers in communities that have historically been underserved, that we have diverse health care providers. It's a critical role for HBCUs to play in preparing that diverse health care workforce. We've got big criminal justice disparities. Maryland actually incarcerates young black men at the highest rate in the country, higher than Mississippi, higher than Alabama. We need real reform in our youth justice system. We also need to be much smarter about education and job training while folks are incarcerated and reentry supports when folks are coming home. We've got big environmental justice issues, an incinerator in Baltimore that fills our kids' lungs with toxins that cause asthma that lead kids to miss a lot of school. We ought to shut that incinerator down. So, you know, there are so many elements to trying to address the black agenda, but there has to be a commitment to real equity and opportunity.
So let's talk about education, since that is arguably your wheelhouse. You kind of, you know, listed, including education, some of the issues. But what's the plan? You know, I went to public school in Prince George's County. Prince George's County has been throwing money at the school system since I was a kid. It has not been the solution to fixing the schools. So, you know, Mr. Secretary, how do you fix that?
Yeah, I would say money is sort of necessary but not sufficient, right? You've got to have the resources to have adequate facilities, to hire strong teachers and a strong staff of education support professionals. But then there are a lot of programmatic pieces that have to be in place. We ought to be doing a lot more to focus on early grades literacy in Maryland, making sure that kids are strong readers by third grade, because the reality is, if you're not a strong reader by third grade, your chances of graduating from high school, going on to college, getting a good job, go down dramatically. So we need better professional development. We need more reading specialists. We need intensive tutoring to provide support to kids who are struggling readers. In the upper grades, you know, I was a high school teacher. I know very well that one of the keys for success in high school is helping every student find their passion, the thing that they are excited about that's going to drive them. Unfortunately, we have real disparities across our schools. Some schools offer advanced placement courses, early college programs, fantastic career and technical education opportunities to prepare for jobs in everything from cybersecurity to welding to healthcare. And then other schools have very few of those offerings, and so much less for kids to connect to and be excited about. So the blueprint for Maryland's future actually gives us resources to address both the early grades literacy challenge and the high school college and career readiness challenge. We've got to make sure we have the pipeline of teachers we need. You know, as a country, majority of our kids are kids of color. Only 18% of our teachers are teachers of color. Only 2% of our teachers are black men. So there's a lot of work to do to make sure that kids can see themselves reflected in their educators and their school leaders. I've called for investing particularly in programs at our HBCUs and community colleges to create that pipeline of diverse teachers, racially diverse, linguistically diverse. So we've got some great opportunities around because we have the resources to work on making all of our schools as strong as possible. Mm-hmm. So it isn't just pockets of excellence, but actually excellence across the board.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking to John King in our Candidates Corner. John King is running for governor as a Democrat in the state of Maryland. If you have a comment, if you have a question for him, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. One other question about education. You talked about, you know, the teacher pipeline. As we know, over the past just several weeks, there have been a clarion call for more teachers in Montgomery County and in Prince George's County. This is something that is not just particular to these two most populous counties in the state, but across the country. So what is the John King secret sauce for helping these counties and others in the state bring more teachers in when teachers are retiring, worn out from the pandemic, and some of the other issues that are causing them to throw up their hands and just say, you know, as we say, make you want to holler and just leave?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've got to address both pay and working conditions. So on the pay side, you know, this blueprint for Maryland's future that recently passed, if we fund it fully, which I'm committed to, will allow us to raise teacher pay. And I've called for raising starting salaries to at least $60,000 throughout the state by 2023. So we're going to make sure that people have competitive salaries. And with other professions that require the kind of degrees and training that teaching does. But then there are a lot of working conditions issues. You know, in Baltimore, for example, as you know, every winter, there are stories of teachers and kids in classrooms in hats and gloves because the heat doesn't work. And every spring and fall, there are stories of schools shutting down because there's not adequate air conditioning to be in the building and the heat is overwhelming. So that's a working condition issue.
Mr. King, please hold. Yeah. Don't forget your point. I've got to take a really quick break and I'll let you finish.
Yeah,
we're going to take a break, but don't forget you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Insight segment via podcast on our website, whur.com, and download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone and hear the program live in its entirety. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. John Mons is next. With the original Quiet Storm on WHUR, we'll be back on SiriusXM Channel 141 with the rest of this conversation. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our Candidates Corner series with John King as he takes a run at the governor's office in Maryland. Mr. King, please continue your point. We were talking specifically about recruiting more teachers and keeping them engaged in Maryland state school systems.
Absolutely. So, you know, I started with raising pay, but then addressing working conditions. And I talked about the challenges of the facilities in Baltimore, but there are other working conditions issues. I was talking the other day to a school counselor in Prince George's County who's responsible for supporting nearly 700 kids and families on her own. That's impossible. You know, the recommended ratio of students to counselors is 250 to 1. So it makes her job impossible, but it also means for teachers in her school, when they have kids who are struggling with socio-emotional challenges, they don't have someone to refer them to because of the counselor being overwhelmed. So that's a working conditions issue that we need to address. We have places in the state where the class sizes are huge, working conditions issue. So we've really got to be intentional on both the salary and working conditions issue side. And then we've got to create better incentives for people to enter the teaching profession. I've called for a loan forgiveness so that folks who commit to teach in subjects where we desperately need people, bilingual teachers, teachers of students with disabilities, teachers in math and science, we ought to cover the cost of school for them, forgive their loans as they serve in our schools. if teachers are willing to teach in places where we're struggling to recruit folks, some of our rural communities, we ought to, over time, as they serve students in Maryland, forgive their loans. That's a way to attract people and make it more financially sustainable for them to be teachers.
You mentioned Baltimore earlier. A couple of things about Baltimore. I live there, actually. And one of the biggest issues for the city generally is crime, the homicide rate. It is arguably out of control. What role would a Governor John King play in helping Baltimore deal with that? Do you believe that a governor or the state government can play a role, or do you believe that it's a hands-off thing?
No, the state has to be engaged and really has to be a partner with the city and with multiple agencies, you know, with the county, with state's attorney's office. You know, you need everyone well-coordinated, federal, state, and local. There are some specific things that Governor Hogan could and should do right now, and that I will certainly do as governor. We need much better oversight of folks who are on probation, parole, home detention. That's a role that the state can play. The state's responsible in those areas and needs to staff them adequately. But then I worry that the conversation about crime and violence focuses just on policing. And the reality is Baltimore is, you know, third or fourth in the country in the ratio of police officers to citizens. If policing alone could solve the challenges, there wouldn't be challenges. So we need a strategy that's really policing plus, you know, policing plus violence prevention programs like Safe Streets, policing plus mental health services and addiction treatment, policing plus reentry programs. You know, 95% of the folks who are incarcerated are coming home. We have to make sure that folks have education and job training while incarcerated and the opportunity to get support, finding a job and housing when they come home. If we were to invest in those other supports, summer jobs for teens, rec centers, if we were to invest in those other supports, then police would be able to focus more intensely on investigating violent crimes. As you know, Baltimore has a very low clearance rate for murders. We want to free up the police to focus on investigating those violent crimes and stopping the flow of illegal guns, which are helping to drive the violence.
As you are also familiar, the squeegee kid murder of the past week has unfortunately put Baltimore in a more unfavorable light. These are teenagers. These are you know, really young people who are out here trying to make a buck, and I would say that it has caused, you know, city leaders and indeed residents a great deal of consternation. How do you fix that kind of issue regarding youth crime and youth violence? Recidivism is one thing. Dealing with, you know, people who are on, you know, parole or probation is one thing. But I mean, let's be honest. We've got a new wave of young people out here who are committing crimes, and in some cases, you know, tarnishing, you know, the tourist industry in Baltimore. How would you fix that?
Let me first say, you know, every part of this recent incident was tragic. You know, what has frustrated me in the kind of discourse around it has been how narrow the focus has been rather than looking at some of the broader systemic issues. You know, if you have young people who are disconnected from school and from work, you need a strategy for how to get them connected. Apprenticeship programs, for example. Opportunities for them to not only have a job, but acquire skills that give them a reason to be hopeful about their future. You know, folks need a way to get to work. You know, I made the point about the governor's terrible decision to cancel the red line and the underinvestment in buses. But as you know, if you make it incredibly difficult for people to get from home to work reliably, then it's much harder for people to sustain employment. You know, you think about the issue of blighted housing in the city and the ways in which abandoned homes become places where violence develops, where folks are using drugs, where folks are living in awful conditions in these abandoned buildings. We need a strategy. We have underinvested as a state in our housing trust fund. You know, D.C. puts $200 million a year into a housing trust fund to build affordable housing, to develop affordable housing projects, to renovate homes that are in need of renovation. Maryland, from the mid-90s to the 2010s, put $50 million into our housing trust fund. D.C. is a tenth our size, so we haven't made the investment. So, you know, the problem is, you know, people want to just focus on the squeegee kids, but they're not looking at the whole context around those young people.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Ms. Lee, calling from D.C. Thanks for hanging on. What's on your mind?
Hi, I am Ms. Lee. I am calling with major concerns for meeting our students at the level where they are. I have a child, and I had to find simple resources just to figure out what my child was struggling with, because the educators that we do have, they don't care, you know. And I feel like if we had those educators that we are now starting to screen just a little bit better on their goals for our students, then we might not be in the situation that we are in. Now, my child struggled with dyslexia. I knew it when she was in, grade school, first grade, second grade. I kept crying out, telling people, you know, she's doing her B's and D's, and, you know, those things were backwards. And then I was told that, you know, you have to go to Georgetown just to get it tested. And, you know, the fee, when I found out, it was almost $2,000 just to have her tested for dyslexia, really angered me. So I started reaching out to different organizations on my own to figure out how I could get proof that my daughter had dyslexia. So I brought her out of school because they were trying to, you know, retain her for certain things that, you know, she had medical issues where she was in the hospital all the time for medical reasons. And NC, how are you going to be NC if you're in a hospital bed? But you're penalized. So, and that brings on, and I'm still real emotional if you can hear it, that brings on depression for your child to say, oh, but I was in hospital. I don't understand why they want to keep me back in hospital.
So, Miss Lee, I don't want to get too far down into the weeds. Because I understand that this is a very, very complex issue. My question for you is, do you have a question about education, for example, for Mr. King in Maryland?
The question is, when are we going to provide the resources that is needed at grade school to help our children prior to reaching high school? Because at that point, it's too late.
Okay, Mr. King.
So, when are the resources...
Go ahead, Mr. King.
Sure. Well, Ms. Lee, first, I'm sorry for the struggle that you had to go through with your child. You know, I think this issue around dyslexia is really a national challenge, that we have not done a good enough job as a country training elementary school teachers to use the science of reading in elementary instruction to make sure that all kids are exposed, for example, to phonics, which we know helps to help all students better access reading. We also don't screen all students for dyslexia the way we should, because if we can identify it early, we can intervene early. We need reading specialists in schools, you know, folks who have deeper training to support kids with dyslexia or other language-based learning disabilities. One of my priorities as governor will be to make sure that we organize our schools so that there's support to get every child to proficiency in reading by third grade. I should say, you know, teachers are sometimes feeling overwhelmed, especially now as we emerge from the consequences of COVID and all the disruptions to school. And one of the things I've called for is mobilizing a statewide tutoring corps, young recent college graduates, retired teachers who can work with students one-on-one, two-on-one to help them catch up academically, but also to provide critical mentoring support.
Ms. Lee, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Charles calling from Ellicott City. Thanks for calling, Charles. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, he had some great solutions for education, but he didn't touch upon the value of parental involvement as far as its importance in promoting and escalating and supporting schools, children in the administration. I'd like him to speak to that.
Absolutely, hugely important. I mean, really parents have to be partners throughout their kids' educational experience. A couple of things that I think we could be doing a much better job of as a state. One is, you know, we have some small programs where nurses visit the homes of new parents to help them think about how to support their kids' health and well-being, help them see the importance of creating language-rich environments where they're talking with their child, doing things like making sure that there are locks on windows, that they're addressing lead paint, those sort of issues. And we really should make that program available, certainly to all low-income families in the state, to have that nurse family visitation. In fact, in many other countries, that's just an assumed part of the process of having a child, is the assumption that you will have that support from a nurse early on to help you orient to being a new parent. We need to do more to support teachers and principals around ways to positively engage families. That has to be a key part of teacher and principal training. And we have to make sure that we provide the support so that parents can engage. You know, we don't have the $15 minimum wage throughout Maryland. So we have parents who are working multiple jobs because just to make it possible for them to have a roof over their heads. That makes it a huge challenge to be able to be the kind of partner they might want for their kids. So there are economic issues, barriers that we have to get out of the way so that parents can be those full partners and that all parents ultimately want to be.
Charles, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Mr. King, where do you stand on a second gas tax holiday in the state of Maryland?
You know, I think this gas tax proposal from, you know, Comptroller Franchot and Governor Hogan is really a gimmick. You know, the evidence is that it's not going to translate into very much savings. It depletes us of resources that we ought to be using to invest in public transportation. And it sets us back in terms of our work to move away from fossil fuels towards renewable energy. So I'd much rather see us prioritize investments in public transportation, making sure public transportation is affordable and, where possible, free, and also investing in building 10,000 charging stations throughout the state so that we can help people move over to electric vehicles. You know, the reality is we're sort of hostage as not just a country, as a world, to dictators with oil fields. And the way to end that is to move us to electric vehicles and renewable energy.
So, and I get all of that. But if I am sitting at my kitchen table, I'm not thinking about dictators with oil fields. If I'm trying to figure out how I need to decide whether or not to feed my kids, in the state of Maryland or drive to work, and if I can save an extra $3 to $4 every time I fill up, and say I fill up twice a week, that really makes a difference. With all due respect, as I said, if I have to try to make that decision, I can't afford a Tesla. So, and Mr. Franchot said last night that Maryland has a $7 billion surplus. That's a lot of scratch. So why not do it again just to give somebody relief? If it's not fiscally practical, wouldn't it be politically expedient?
Well, that's the worry, right? That it is politically expedient, but actually not as beneficial as advertised, because you end up with the companies absorbing a lot of the benefit rather than the customers. I agree that we should be doing more to help people manage this environment of inflation and the costs that they're seeing. You know, one of the best things we could do to tackle inflation as a country, a major investment in childcare. Childcare is a huge driver of family expenses. It's actually forcing a lot of people out of the workforce, which is helping to drive our supply chain challenges. I've proposed universal affordable child care in Maryland using some of that $7 billion surplus to say every family will cap the cost of child care at 7% of their income. And that's an immediate benefit. Another challenge we have in the state, prescription drugs. That's a huge burden on folks. They have health conditions, huge burden on seniors. We have a prescription drug affordability board as a state, but it only applies to public health plans, not to private insurers. Let's expand that to private insurers. Let's get the cost of prescription drugs under control in the state. So I'm all on board with trying to make it easier for folks to navigate the day-to-day challenges within their means, but we don't do that with gimmicks.
The other issue, we asked all of the candidates this question. It seems that Maryland, and specifically in Prince George's County, for example, there just seems to be a problem with getting the grass cut. It may seem like a very, very simple thing, but image is everything. Perception is everything. And I've said this to Mr. Franchot. I've said this to Wes Moore, that it's like elephant grass in Vietnam on some of these state roads. What would you do to fix that?
You know, one of the problems that we have is the state, and this has been particularly true over the Hogan years, the state passes costs on to counties, where the counties end up having to pick up the cost of so many services, and that ends up with higher property taxes and less reliable services from the county. To me, a better approach would be for the state to ask large corporations and the multimillionaires, folks who are making multiple millions a year, to pay their fair share so that the state can better partner with counties around these services. Now, where the state is responsible for a state road, you know, making sure that the state handles its responsibility for upkeep of the grass, you know, that's part of the state government's job, and we have to hold people accountable at every level of government. But so much of the challenge falls on counties, and the state, unfortunately, has allowed counties to absorb too much of the burden of public services because the state's been unwilling to make the tax fairness changes we need.
What kind of support would you offer small businesses in the state outside of the contracting process? Because certainly, as we know, the contracting process with the state is big business, but not everybody can be a state or even a county contractor.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, certainly there are some things we can do to improve the state contracting process to make it easier for small businesses, particularly businesses owned by Black and Latino folks, to access those state contracts. And we've got a plan to help folks. We'll check out on our website, johnkingforgovernor.com, where we talk about procurement reform. But one of the things that is a big challenge when I talk to small business owners in every part of the state is access to capital. I was in Hagerstown a few months back talking to two African-American women who just opened a juice bar, Tribe Cold Press. And they had this great idea of a juice bar. There's going to be a new baseball stadium in downtown Hagerstown. It's a great opportunity for retail. So they opened this business. It's beautiful, all new equipment, newly designed space. It was lovely. And I said to them, well, where'd you get the resources to start the business? And they said, well, we had to empty our retirement, borrow from friends and family. And so that's an example of what happens when folks don't have access to capital. A solution that we've proposed is something that the state of North Dakota has done. It's the only state that's done this, just to take the state assets and put them into a state bank and then partner with community banks to make it easier for folks to get access to capital to start and grow their businesses. So, you know, they're still profitable loans, but they're not as profitable as maybe the big commercial banks would expect, but they're profitable for the bank and for the community. And so that state bank would be an immediate benefit to small business owners. Another thing we need to do is fix the state's relationship with small business owners. You know, people complain about how hard it is to get licenses, permits, get guidance on getting their business started. So we propose significantly increasing the state's Office of Small Minority and Women-Owned Businesses and making sure that they are customer service focused so that small business owners get the information they need and the support they need navigating the state bureaucracy.
I'm sure you've seen the Washington Post article about Charles County being the most affluent, predominantly African-American county, not only in the state, but in the nation, snatching that title that was long held by Prince George's County. What are your thoughts about that?
You know, I mean, if one of the great strengths of the state is that, you know, we have so much diversity and we have diversity across income levels. You know, the thing that we have to make sure we do, though, is have the services to match that. So, you know, I'm sure you hear this all the time in Prince George's County, the frustration with not having the same retail opportunities that folks find in Montgomery County. I know that's something that the state can help to address, make it easier for quality retail development to happen, particularly near metro stops, for example. In Charles County, one of the things we think about is how do we address the tremendous traffic that folks are experiencing? And that, to me, could be helped immensely by building the Southern Maryland Light Rail Project. Senator Ellis has been a long advocate for that. If you built the Southern Maryland Light Rail Project, you could do mixed-use development at the stops along the way, including great retail opportunities. That will improve folks' quality of life. It'll get them out of their cars and improve their quality of life with less time sitting in traffic.
I'm sure also that County Executive Angela Also Brooks probably would be a tad bit more discouraged if this change has happened while she was in office. And so what, from your perspective, does Prince George's County need to either reclaim that title or at least be in the running? Is it dealing with property taxes? Is it dealing with crime? Is it cutting the grass? What do you say?
You know, I think one of the things that's happened is gentrification in D.C. has pushed folks out into Prince George's County. And, you know, we've got to make sure that we have in the D.C. metro region an adequate supply of affordable housing and real economic development opportunities. We've got to grow the number of good jobs. So, for example, we have thousands of open cybersecurity jobs in the D.C. metro region, but only tiny programs at our community colleges and HBCUs to prepare people for those cybersecurity jobs. We need to grow those programs significantly so that the folks who want those jobs can get what are very good jobs in the private sector and the public sector.
In the last minute or so, share with us who Michelle Seery is.
Yeah, so Michelle Seery is my running mate. She is currently the executive director of the Women's Law Center of Maryland. Before that, was president of the board at Planned Parenthood. The former assistant attorney general has spent her life really as an advocate for gender equity and reproductive freedom. It's one of the reasons Pro-Choice Maryland has endorsed our ticket. It's because of Michelle's incredible record. She's also been a career-long advocate for quality child care, for paid family leave, for raising the minimum wage, for equal pay, for equal work. And she would make an outstanding lieutenant governor. And I hope after 8 years, maybe run for governor herself.
That's a great resume. What kind of person is she? Because as you know, whether it's president, dog catcher, or anything in between, a lot of people are... particularly when we're talking about this really large Democratic field, you know, all of you kind of have the same kind of thing, you know, pro-choice, you know, dealing with, you know, black and brown issues, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, why does she stand out to you?
Yeah, a couple of things. One is, you know, she's Iranian American. Her family was living in Iran before the Iranian Revolution in 1979, and had to flee, had to come to the United States. And so she has a very deep appreciation for the fragility of our civil rights and human rights and the urgency of protecting those rights. And so we really share a passion for civil rights and social justice. She also is... you know, a working mom who is experiencing the challenges of the sandwich generation. She's got kids in school in Baltimore County, and then she's got a mom who's recently diagnosed with a significant illness, and she's juggling, as so many Marylanders are, trying to support her kids and trying to support aging parents, and is very conscious of the crisis of care that we face as a state. Not enough affordable care for kids, particularly our little ones, and then real crisis of care around elders.
Well, Mr. King, I am out of time, but thank you so much. John King, thank you so much for talking to us. Good luck to you, sir. I'm sure we'll be in touch.
Thank you for the conversation. Such a pleasure.
That is the Daily Drum for this Wednesday, July 13th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.